First Fuel, a podcast bringing you perspectives on the role of energy efficiency, energy management, and demand response in the energy transition taking place in Australia and around the world. I'm Luke Menzel, CEO of the Energy Efficiency Council, and this week I'm joined by John Connor. John is CEO of the Carbon Market Institute, an independent industry association for businesses leading the transition to net zero emissions. Hello, John, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Luke. Pleased to be here.
Great. Well, John, you're joining us in a huge week for the global conversation around climate change. On Monday evening here in Australia, we saw the release of the latest report on the physical science from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and we brought you on to help us unpack it all, which you're well placed to do, given your credentials in the climate space. You had time as campaigns director at ACF, as CEO of the Climate Institute, and of course, you're executive director of Fiji's Presidency Secretariat for the 23rd Conference of Parties back in 2017. So we could probably get you on again at some point to share the war stories from that incredibly illustrious career, which is continuing with CMI. I'm keen to get your reactions to this report, which has certainly garnered a huge amount of attention and indeed a huge amount of concern around the world.
Yeah, thanks, Luke. A few war wounds, but look, I think it's an important report. This is the latest in the round of the reports that the panel does. It's very important to understand that, like the UNFCCC itself, this is a document, the summary for policymakers is signed off by all nations, and so Australia and other countries own this document, and it's a core part of now their duty of care, if you like, of understanding what is foreseeable and are happening right now. So I think that's an important point to make clear from the outset. And look, in lots of ways, there's no real surprises in this report, but there is greater certainty in the range of the impacts and the task at hand.
Yeah, and that's the thing for those of us that follow this space closely is, as you say, this is almost providing a greater degree of certainty of things that there was a high degree of confidence on already. I think you make a good point around the incredibly thorough process this report has been through, the involvement of governments around the world, to the degree that some people are still trying to prosecute a kind of debate around the reality of climate change. And I'm pleased to say there's less and less of that as time goes on. But this report, I think, John, puts it beyond any shadow of the doubt that these are the facts, and the choice we have before us is what to do about them.
That's right. And the challenge is not so much, although it's still a bit of it out there, of denial, but of delay. And so it's actually so incumbent then on companies and countries to be strengthening their targets and their policies. And we've seen a lot of action in the private. People call it the voluntary market, but I think it's actually not true. A lot of that's under pressure from investors, from shareholders, and from consumers that we're seeing companies now really taking this on. But a lot of them, like they are in the energy efficiency space, are surprised once they actually turn over this book in their energy and carbon strategies, that there are savings to be had and opportunities to be had. And so one of the focus that we have here is to look at the opportunities. But it really is important, and I think even the Prime Minister is understanding this more, that this is a challenge around capital and investment, and it's a global one, and one certainly that companies are looking at. And the backdrop, of course, to the IPCC report was the European Commission report, which looked at expanding their carbon market, looked at extra issues in energy efficiency, transport, land use. But, of course, they had a carbon border adjustment as well, which other countries are looking at. And so this is an issue of climate impacts, but it's also of global capital and investment flows as well.
And I know with your members there at the Carbon Market Institute, you do have some of Australia's leading companies, and many of them very well integrated into global markets. And so there's having attended CMI summits in the past and having a number of great conversations at them, I know there's a really sophisticated understanding within your membership of those interactions. How would you characterise your members' views on how Australia should be responding to some of those pressures?
Well, I think there's a broad, I mean, we're an interesting body, and my predecessor described we're highest common denominator amongst that amongst that membership. We're not a peak body as such, but look, most of the companies are getting on with it. They're looking to build their capacities and skills, and we've actually seen a surge in our membership, but also a surge in carbon market activity. People are re-establishing commodity trading desks for carbon environment and other commodities. There's a deeper need to get these strategies, and I think a pivotal moment has been the focus on the net zero strategies. Now, it's not enough by itself in terms of either shorter term targets or the realization that, frankly, we need to be negative emission in net and absolute terms in coming decades. And I might come back to that point. But so companies are beginning to realize that, but realizing there's a whole range of issues they need to be clear about in this transition. Having a transition strategy, which means sort of working with community affected communities, workers as well, making sure their terminology is right. And so there's a lot of risks of greenwash and that's in here, and making sure that they're getting that hierarchy right around avoidance, reduction and offsetting. So a lot of traps in that, and a couple of members already been caught out with some of the offsets that are purchased there. There's pressures to make it deal with their portfolio. There are some cheaper international carbon permits elsewhere, but that they are running out as well. But there are some risks within all of those. So companies are looking really at we're certainly working with them as to this, the fine grained stuff. But they're desperate to see some policy guidance as well, because while I think we've got this private policy engine which is really starting to move and investors are moving on this, we need to make sure the public policy engine is there, because at the end of the day, we need to have a significant value on carbon reduction, and that's very much the case if we need to get the negative emissions, because we're going to need to have markets set up to drive and value those carbon reductions.
I almost hear it from the other side in terms of the Energy Efficiency Council's members, which are often the businesses that are supporting CMI members in their, you know, energy and carbon management journey. And we're hearing and we're engaged with these companies as they go on that that journey of building their literacy in this space. And that's something that is happening incredibly rapidly. And it's sort of the twin drivers almost of cost and carbon, and kicking off in 2017 when you had those incredible electricity and gas price spikes for many companies, that was a bit of a wake-up call. But then as carbon has rocketed up the agenda, it's almost become an integrated story for the more sophisticated companies, how we manage, you know, our exposure to both cost and carbon. But going to your policy point, what is happening is not just a literacy being built within Australian businesses around, you know, what they might be doing or what their peers might be doing or how they might benchmark internationally. It's a literacy around, you know, some of the policy gaps that we have here in Australia and how that is having flow-on effects for, you know, all the things we've been talking about motivating action here in Australia, but, you know, our competitiveness and potential impacts on trade going forward. And so that just ratchets up the pressure on action around policy here in Australia. And I suppose we'll get to that, and I'm interested in your thoughts on where that policy piece needs to go. But if I take it back to the IPCC report for a moment, I was struck by these five scenarios that they laid out, and it seems to me that the IPCC has almost laid out a choose-your-own-adventure for the world's people, with rapid action allowing us to substantially moderate the worst impacts of climate change and lethargy and inaction resulting in a much less habitable planet. And I know you marinate in the climate science much more than I do, so I'm interested in your views, John, about not necessarily the ins and outs of every single scenario, but what should we be taking out of that, those various pathways that the IPCC has laid out for us?
Look, I think I said at the outset that it's actually more certainty. And I think some of the key things that we've come through in this edition is that we've narrowed the climate sensitivity boundaries. Look, there's been some uncertainty about how much flows from these increases in carbon and the greenhouse gases, heat-trapping gases in our atmosphere. So we're now more certain of that. And so that means that it's good news in the sense that the extremes that many were concerned about may not be fully in picture, but it's also bad news that there's no sneaking away with this. And so that, I think that's a key takeout from this report. But it's reinforced by this and previous reports that every green matters. These are very significant impacts, and that we're having the impacts right now. So I'm probably not so much focused on the breadth of those five and adventures. The main adventure is that we've got to get on with the decarbonisation and the drawdown, because it's very clear that the dangers are happening, that we're at dangerous levels right now, and so we need to be building up the scale of the drawdown, the negative emission technologies, while we also get on with the rapid decarbonisation. So, and that's opportunity as well. So Professor Garnaut talks about these being sort of one of the decarbonisation and the drawdown aspect being one of the four sort of key economic opportunities for Australia in a post-carbon world. But it does need, and it goes back to your literacy points, it needs strong systems of assurance and measurement. We need systems of integrity that are there. We need to be thinking about the kinds of those that draw down as well, and how that can be serviced. And so whilst many of your members may not be so much on the land-based and nature-based, there's a very interesting section and slab of work that we need to do there, and can integrate land and climate and indeed history repair and some of the Indigenous opportunities there. But we're going to need to move to other areas of direct air capture, industrialisation, as well as geological sequestration, all of which is going to require energy and how we use the efficiencies in energy, how we use renewable and the abundant renewable energy we have here in this country to pick up those things. So some of those dimensions will be picked up in later IPCC reports and mitigation and adaptation. But this report highlights it. We've just got to get cracking on it because the risks are real.
Yeah, I note that there's a report coming which is focused on the solutions. This is very much focused on defining the problem. So we have that to look forward to. Hey, John, I know you're thinking a lot about Glasgow and some of the big conversations that will come to a head just a few months away now in November. Did you want to give us a sense of the headline issues that our listeners at home should be keeping an eye out for that really need to be resolved at Glasgow for us to get this conversation on the right track?
Yeah, so this Convention of the Parties or COP, it should actually be one, actually not so much on the negotiation. It's actually supposed to be one more about reporting and strengthening targets. And so that's actually the headline task, and why we're actually seeing some significant leadership from the Conservative government in the UK calling on much stronger targets for 2050, but also 2030. They're beginning prosecuting a very vigorous case around coal and other aspects. But the continued progress of the Paris Agreement now kicking into place does, at that meta level, need that ambition on targets, but also finance. And so it's the key thing that brings the developing countries, and our Prime Minister's been strong about the developing countries in the recent days, but what brings them to the table is the commitment from those countries that have benefited from a high carbon economy in that transition to be providing public and private investment. So making sure they've got the architecture channels that are there for the public and private finance. Still a lot of work to do in that area, and Australia's focused its climate finance into the Pacific region. That's great, but there's a quantum of that needs to be expanded, and we also need to be assisting collaborative vehicles there. There's a Green Climate Fund. So there's a bunch of work on that in terms of the quantum the government has. The government's actually interestingly looking at regional carbon crediting schemes and looking at building up integrity and assurance there, which is going to be important. All of which flows back into the sort of there's a vestige, a remnant that's sort of been left over from previous COPs in an area, what's called Article 6, which is the rules for carbon markets within the Paris Agreement. Now, This is about making the most efficient transition. And so there are countries who are going to be harder to make some of this transition in early stages. How can they make it cheaper by taking up opportunities from other countries who can have quicker drawdown? The framework is already being used under Article 6. We're seeing Switzerland, for example, make deals with Peru for some offsets that can be there and can be married into their accounts. But we've got to get some fine-grained detail on how those adjustments are made between the parties, but also how we can actually activate the international market between companies and get investment flows in these activities. So there needs to be rules there around and in Article 6. And as I say, this is where there is still negotiations. And because it wasn't done as part of the package in Madrid and previous COPs, it's kind of hanging out like the proverbial. And so it will attract all the other political attention. But in that, there's three key issues in this Article 6 area. One is the rules around corresponding adjustments. And so you actually have to increase your emissions from a country that's shipping the credits across to another country. Some other countries don't like that too much because they want to get the carbon benefit as well. But there's rules around double counting that we can't need to be made clear. And so there's work to do on that. The second area is around pre-2020, pre-Paris commitments. Now, been a lot of focus on Australia, which was a very unfortunate and obstacle in Madrid, and I think there's consequences for that around the Kyoto carryovers, how we actually as a nation can we carry these forward into the Paris Agreement process. Now, the government's not completely said, but has said it won't use those credits, but there is still a vast range of credits that have been there in the developing countries from the Kyoto era. Countries like Brazil and others want to see prosecuted and benefited and still survive into the Paris Agreement. There's a lot of argy-bargy around that, so it may be some compromises around some vintage. When's the last of those that you can use? Are there limits on them? Those sorts of things. There really shouldn't be much transition at all, if at all, but that's one of the things there. And the third element is actually around the share of the proceeds of these markets. And so under the Kyoto market, which had developing countries providing developed countries with Kyoto commitments, there was a percentage of the trades that actually then went into an adaptation fund and provided some finance. So how that might work underneath those arrangements are important and goes back to my prior point about the finance being a very significant part of keeping the momentum amongst all the parties moving forward. So there's some of the key dimensions that are there. So Australia needs to have a credible package on finance, needs to have should be having obviously commits to net zero by 2050, should be strengthening its 2030 targets, and should be strengthening the and being able to demonstrate to others that we've got the policy framework behind that. We're yet to see significant movement in those areas, but it is doing some interesting things in the region.
That's an excellent point around those midterm commitments. So the bulk of the conversation here in Australia, certainly on the political level, it's sort of very caught up with net zero by 2050, which is yes. That is something which, you know, is I think increasingly being treated as table stakes around the world. It's no great shakes with some of our peers around the world say, oh well, we're signing up for net zero by 2050. As you know, John, the great progress we've made in this year with some of our peer economies, if I can call them that, you know, the Canadas, the United States, the Japans of the world, is a significant strengthening of their, you know, their 2030 commitments, what they're doing over the next 10 years. Could you unpack what you would see as a credible 2030 target for Australia to be taking into Glasgow and perhaps some of the other things that the federal government, should they be minded to do so, could take to Glasgow to show that they were serious about playing their role on the global stage?
Yeah, look, And I think it is important to say that it's not just Australia. This is not just having a go at the Australian government. Most of the economies haven't got enough commitment there, and that's why it's been important to see countries like the US, Canada, UK and others strengthening their 2030 targets as well as their net zero by 2050 targets. it's a bloody hard task that'll get to decarbonise our economies, but and why it's important we get the settings right and make the decisions now, because, well, as you in the energy efficiency space know so well, our buildings and others, that infrastructure hang around for some time. So, look, I think we need to be making a contribution towards that if we're serious around the 1.5-degree goals, as we do tell our Pacific colleagues, as Australia, the government, I mean, there, then global emissions and those from particularly from advanced economies need to be halving by 2030 along that pathway to net zero by 2050. We need to be strengthening our policies. Now, one of the things, and it's not just because we're called the Carbon Market Institute, but we've got that I try to say is we actually have carbon markets and pricing in this country. We have this, we've spent too much time on the political wedges and the slogans in this country, and I think we need to move on. And I've been delighted by companies now who are realising this more. Out of the removal of the carbon pricing mechanism of the Prime Minister Gillard, we've got the safeguard mechanism and the emissions reduction fund. And the safeguard mechanism with the baselines was intended to sort of be a barrier to emissions rising. Now we're seeing that rise in some of the sectors, variety of loopholes and coverage and other things that your members will be familiar with. But there is still some compliance there. So you may be surprised that there's tens of thousands of credits having to be purchased and traded each year for some companies, some mines and some operations that are actually breaching those baselines. Ironically, just recently, some purchases of Australian Carbon Credit Units, which are the only ones you can use to redeem that, were trading at above $23 for in a couple of years' time to make those payments, and so which is above the initial fixed price of the Gillard pricing mechanism. So that's real, and that's real for companies, and particularly some of the LNG sector, which will face some of those obligations in coming years in increasing ways. But we do have carbon markets. So that safeguard mechanism we think is a key opportunity to be evolved. And so what we think and suggest is that we could have those baselines be trending more downwards, partly also because we've got what's been driving some of the emissions reductions and is from the government has been this emissions reduction fund where they've been purchasing carbon. So there's a price on carbon. The last auction was about $16 a tonne and they'll have one in October. So a credible policy should have the stronger 2030 targets of net zero by 2050. But policies like a strengthening of the safeguard mechanism, we need to have clearer sectoral decarbonisation strategies where your work and policies are important. And I think there are opportunities and hearing the Nats and they're going to be important around that we actually grasp this as this political dilemma as an opportunity as well. We've been calling for a land and environment investment fund to really make sure we're integrating the ecosystem health benefits of some of the work that's happening in carbon farming and other areas to actually marry these together to actually rebuild the resilience and the health of some of our ecosystems to be productive units. And I think that's also been a very, very interesting thing across our membership is to see the surge of interest and passion from pretty hardened farmers, not only in the carbon values but also in the regenerative agricultural capacities that can be done if we take a fresh look at how we use our landscape.
First Fuel is brought to you by the Energy Efficiency Council, a not-for-profit membership association for businesses, universities, governments and NGOs. The Council's mission is to unlock the potential of energy efficiency to deliver healthy, comfortable buildings, productive, competitive businesses and an affordable, reliable and sustainable energy system for Australia. To find out how your organisation can get involved, visit eec.org.au/membership.
I might pick you up on your comment around the need for sectoral decarbonisation pathways because faithful listeners to the podcast will know this is a bit of a hobby horse of mine, is that we have this kind of economy-wide conversation and it's all very amorphous, but there's we still haven't done the really hard work of actually breaking down the task before us and thinking through how we work through the emissions reduction task in manufacturing, in commercial buildings, in residential in the resources sector, in agriculture, because they're different cohorts, there's different stakeholders, and it's really important that each of those groups, each of those parts of the economy really see themselves in that low emissions future, but also have an understanding of what, you know, the levers they can pull, the technologies they can bring to bear, the support that they can access. And I noticed in some of your comments this week, you've called for development of a clean industry research and development strategy to support sectoral decarbonisation. Did you just want to talk to that?
Yeah, well, look, I think the hopes that many of us might have had of a very clear and simple economic optimal solution around a cap on a broad economy-wide cap on emissions, and then we let the economy work that out and chase these things through, hasn't happened. And so we just need to be realists in a policy perspective. But that whilst I do fundamentally believe that we need to send some strong price signals, I mean, the safeguard mechanism with declining baselines and the like, I see that as part of a package of just sending clear signals to all sectors of the economy that you need to get on with the decarbonisation and then the other opportunities that might go with that and building industries around that. But we need to realise that we need to tend the garden in the various beds that are there of our economy, and as I say, look at those sectors. There are things, so a broad price on carbon won't necessarily drive, will be an important guide, but won't drive the transition in the transport sector. So we do need things like much higher efficiency standards, and we do need, you know, what others are doing is saying, right, that's it, from 2030 or so, we're not going to allow sales of combustion engine vehicles. Those things are important. It goes to your work in appliances and heat pumps and, you know, these things we do need as part of a coherent policy framework, and we shouldn't be shy of that, and I think that's what we're suggesting.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I have one last question for you, John. As I was scrolling through my feeds yesterday, as everyone was absorbing that IPCC report, I was struck, not from everybody, but certainly from some people, by a sense of alarm, despair, a certain amount of despondency. Now, for those of us that follow this area closely, as we said earlier, there's not necessarily a lot of surprises here, but it is striking to have it reinforced in such a compelling passion, and sort of led to this collective moment of acknowledgement that we are really up against it. You know, that we've got our work cut out for us to address these challenges, and we really got to pull our socks up and get on with it. So as someone that's been consistently engaged on this same issue for many years now, what's your advice for any of our listeners that are feeling challenged by the news this week and what they should do about it?
Well, I think it's important to recognise that. I mean, yeah, it gets you into a funk, this data, the hard data, and you can't avoid that. But, you know, I've got kids as well, but really terrified at the world that's evolving for them. And I've also, my time in the Pacific, you know, seeing this really in first hands, communities having to move, you know, on the third seawall, all those things that make they're very real for you. And I think it's important to recognise and register that grief. But I think it's also, I guess I'd say my role as a professional optimist, we've got to look to the chinks of light. But seriously, I think that this can be seen as a great challenge. I think we probably got caught up on the sustainability ride for too long. It's just too inert a motivator. Yeah. This is the biggest repair job in human history, and I think we need to see that this is... There's a sense of excitement and inclusion in that. And that's one of the ways in which I like to think about this and what we are trying to build and debug it if we're going to be stopped. And you're as resolute a plugger as many around the place as well, that we've got to build some platforms in which our children can spring from. And they are there. We can see them. We can work away at them. We are seeing benefits from them. It's great in my mind to see that carbon markets are re-emerging and even around those sorts of formal negotiations. So with the so-called voluntary markets, and that we're seeing people and business recognise this more from their own get-go. But we can build from that, and so that's where I perhaps like to focus on the it's on the repair. It's too late for pessimism. It's now we've just got to get on with this repair job.
Well, indeed, I feel like we're in the third act of the movie. Things are looking pretty dire, but our heroes are about to rise to the occasion. Hey, John.
Yeah. And they will be many, and I think that's what, you know, let's move beyond the Marvel comics and look for the heroes. Or, you know, I was there in Copenhagen when everyone waited as Obama's plane landed, and, you know, we thought he'd save the day. Heroes are the people that are listening in on this podcast and working away and helping and working with you and your team and with the teams that I have that can build this policy. It's not going to be an individual. We've got to tackle this from all of our organisations and resonate with that sense of repair would be my advice.
Hear, hear. And, well, while it was great to see you strutting the world stage for a few years there, I was delighted when you re-entered the fray here in Australia when you took on the gig at CMI. We're lucky to have someone of your calibre fighting the good fight here in Australia, and good luck for what is going to be what I think is a pretty interesting few months as we head into Glasgow, John. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Luke.
All right, well, that wraps up this episode of First Fuel. If you have comments, you can find us on Twitter. John is at JConnorOz and my handle is at Luke Benzel. And to keep up to date on the latest in energy efficiency, energy management and demand response, you can follow the Energy Efficiency Council at EE Council. If Twitter is not your thing, you can email the team. The address is firstfuel@eec.org.au, and make sure you never miss an episode by subscribing to First Fuel in your podcast app of choice. And to learn more about the show, including upcoming live recordings, and there's a few of them coming up, visit eec.org.au/podcasts. But for now, it's goodbye from us, and we'll catch you soon.